Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Previously on the Mike Wise Show.
Darlene, you just described this entire show. This is the best of Mike Wise 2.0. That's right. This time it's personal. We started the show in January of 2019, and this week we're looking back at some of our most interesting discussions. But first, Darlene, do your thing!
The Mike Wise Show is a presentation of Pure Hoops Media. The Mike Wise Show is hosted by a guy who played basketball atrociously for Hawaii Pacific College, which forced him into journalism. And, oh yeah, he wrote about basketball for the New York Times, the Washington Post, and ESPN. He's also a wise ass, and so are many of his guests. Right, Mike?
Jason Whitlock of Fox Sports is a good friend with whom I disagree frequently. In fact, we agree on practically nothing. Jason is a well-known contrarian who loves stirring things up. Recently, we were discussing the value of coaches expressing their opinions on social issues. In Whitlock's beloved NFL, coaches usually avoid speaking out. But in the NBA, there are coaches like Steve Kerr and Greg Popovich who are not shy about addressing societal issues. I'm not saying the NBA doesn't have its own flaws. If we're talking about leagues that are interested in having coaches and players express themselves. Well, do you have one coach that will talk like Popovich or Steve Kerr?
Thank God we don't. Thank God the NFL doesn't. And Kerr aren't qualified, Mike. They're damn gym teachers trying to run into the history class and tell everybody what they should be doing in history.
They're just as qualified as you and I to speak about social justice. And
which we're not that qualified, Mike.
All right. Well, but I said you still have your views and I still have my views about it. So why wouldn't they be able to? I have no problem with those guys speaking. I don't look at them as. I don't look at them as Cornel West and Todd Boyd, but I certainly will listen to them because.
For them to virtue signal, for them to put on. It's a slogan. It's a gimmick.
You don't think there's conviction? They're just trying to basically ingratiate themselves to their black players.
Absolutely, that's the number one priority.
Wow, I'd reject that. I mean, come on.
I know.
A guy can't have a conviction. A guy can't have a conviction about something. It has to be for a reason.
Yeah, Mike, because trust me, Mike, as much as you love Pop and Kerr for all that left-wing bullshit they spew, if one of these coaches or one of these players, black or white, came out and argued the other side, they would be crucified. It takes no courage to do what Pop and Kerr are doing, none. They get celebrated and applauded, and you all pretend like, oh, my God, these guys are so courageous.
They get killed. They get killed by their own fan base.
Are you kidding me, Mike?
They get killed by fan bases and the other people that are more conservative than them. They just got killed by you. You're a pretty big voice in the media. They get killed by – who's that other whack?
One guy.
From Clay Travis.
Yeah, one guy. One guy. Come on, Mike.
You're not – but I – look – well, here's where we agree. If we're going to celebrate somebody saying the president is white supremacist, we also have to be at least tolerant, if not accepting, of athletes and coaches who come out on the other side. Kurt Schilling might be a little bit rash,
and I'm glad they don't. To be honest with you, because they all need to stay out of it, not qualified. It's just virtue signaling. Again, you won't see me standing out here screaming anything about politics because, first, I'm not qualified.
One guest who is qualified to comment on Kerr and Pop is a man who won rings with both as an assistant coach. Mike Brown won his first championship as Pop's assistant with the 2003 Spurs before becoming a head coach for the Cavaliers and Lakers. He's currently Steve Kerr's top assistant at Golden State, and he would certainly disagree with Jason's virtue signaling tag about Pop.
What I learned working for Greg Popovich is to empower those guys, because when you do, you're always going to get something in return, and some of the things that you may get in return may help your team win a crucial ball game in a 7-game series during your playoff run. So if you empower those guys because of their feel, because of their intelligence, you'll get a whole lot in return coming back, because they're more than just gifted basketball players out on the floor.
Pop did more than just empower his players. He did the same with his assistant coaches. And the Spurs brand of emotional intelligence can be found all over the league as former Spurs move into other organizations, such as Golden State. I was thinking about the other day, the Spurs and the Warriors just have so much. You talk about family. You have Steve. I look, Bruce Bernstein, a man we both know, and you worked with at ESPN for a while. He texted me a photo of a Spurs roster photo, and seated on the left-hand side is you, Mike Budenholzer, Bud, and PJ Carlissimo. I mean, and then right next to him was R.C. Buford. So, I mean, there's a lot of success out of that organization. It's amazing to me that Brett Brown was on a staff as well. I mean, he's now coaching. I mean, you must run into these guys all the time and talk San Antonio still.
Pop is like the godfather. I mean, there's somebody, and I think there's probably somebody in every single organization out there that has come through San Antonio at some point in time in their careers. Pop does a phenomenal job. Pop and RC, they do a phenomenal job of trying to find the right people to come work for the organization. And then, you know, you learn a lot, you grow a lot while being there, and they help you get to a point to where, you know, you're able to go break off on your own and do your own thing. And not only as an assistant coach or assistant GM or front office guy, coming through there, for instance, Sam Presti, that's where he got his start, and he's the GM president of Oklahoma City. But mm-hmm. not only as a coach or a front office guy, but also as a player. Two guys, if that's the same team that I'm thinking of, you know, you got two guys on that team in Danny Ferry and Steve Kerr, who obviously have yep. had a lot of success as GMs and coaches.
Yeah, they were both players on that team.
Correct. So you know, you go down the line, you see different guys, whether it be as a player or as an assistant coach or a front office guy, come through that organization. A lot of them have had success there and broken off from there and gone on to do some special things in the league.
Hall of Famer Dave Cowens was an assistant coach in San Antonio, but he left the year before Pop started with the Spurs. The former Celtics great was no stranger to aggressive play on the court. He was one of the fiercest competitors of his era. And whether it was battling Kareem in the NBA Finals or just playing pickup ball in East Orange, New Jersey, his intensity was off the charts. You probably don't remember this one, but because it was more a part of someone else's life than yours. But when I was writing Shaquille O'Neal's autobiography and basically ghostwriting it for him about 20 years ago, I spent a lot of time in Apopka, Florida with his parents, including his stepfather, Phil Harrison. And Phil Harrison, besides telling me some great anecdotes about Shaquille when he was little, I said, you played, you were a pretty tough guy. And he goes, well, I thought I was good. And I go, what happened? He goes, well, one day in New Jersey, I'm playing pickup with Dave Cowens and he knocked my teeth out. he said he took an elbow or something from you on the playgrounds. of, I don't know if it was Newark or somewhere in that area. And I'm going, you don't remember knocking out anybody's teeth, do you, outside of the NBA?
Well, that did happen. I was visiting a teammate of mine at in East Orange, and they had a playground that everybody went to, and different factions, you know, different neighborhoods would come to this one place. And, you know, we were just playing, all of a sudden, you know, a big fight broke out, and some guy was on my back, and I'm trying to get him off my back, and I'm looking around going, since I'm the only pale face in the area, I'm going, this is not good. But anyway, things worked out and we survived. And
I had no idea
that the reason it started was because I must have inadvertently done something, because, you know, he says I knocked his teeth out. I don't remember doing it. I don't know how it happened. And that's the way it is most of the time. If you do something like that, you don't even know you did it. And but the funny part of the story was that when Shaquille came into the league, I think it was Penny Hardaway and some other guys that class, I was involved with the rookie orientation program for the NBA. It was when it was just starting. And we were in these classes. It was a 2 or 3 day affair down, I think it was in Dallas, Texas at the time.
Okay.
And we were in a room, like a classroom, and we had a psychologist there, and we had an older guy and a younger, newly retired guy, and Shaquille and these guys were in the classroom. So, you know, we're after the class, Shaquille comes up to me, and I'm looking up at him. He goes, "Hey," he says, "you knocked my dad's two front teeth out." I looked up at him. I said, "You're not going to hurt me, are you?" And he started laughing. that was the funny part of it.
Oh, that's great. Phil Harrison had a story until he passed about Dave Cowens. That's great too. Boy, you almost start a race riot, and years later, Shaquille O'Neal.
Oh my God, yeah, a race riot. It was me. It was one white guy in there, within miles. You know, I said, "Well," but I had my guys were there, the guys that I was visiting with.
Yeah.
But you know, it was. It was just a pickup game, so you never know what's going to happen.
Yeah, I remember talking to Larry one year about how he I said, "What is it like being a white guy in a black league and being a white star in a black league?" And he said, "You know, it's like anything. If you grow 6'9", and whether you're from Indiana or Kuwait, you know, and you work hard and you play, you can make it in the league." And I remembered at the time. Obviously the NBA was a fairer skin when you played than it is now. Billy Hunter, even the executive players director, and Larry said at one point, like, if this league's ever going to take off, really take off, you need another American born white superstar. I look at what's happened in this league and how much LeBron James and Steph Curry and all these guys have become crossover stars. And before anybody looks at their skin color, they look at the player they are. I don't know if you need it. I mean, it'd be nice just for diversity's sake, but I don't know if you need an American-born white superstar anymore.
Well, I think you have questions about that, about why there aren't as many American-born white players. But you don't have to worry about that because it's an international game, and all the white people are from other countries
that
are in this league now. I think there's only maybe 30 to 40 white players in the NBA from the United States.
Yes.
Right now, you know, out of 450. So a country that, you know, as big as we are, it's unique and it's curious as to why you don't have more American-born white players in the NBA right now.
While there are fewer American-born white players in the NBA, the fans and media seem to notice race more than the guys who play the game. Hall of Famer Chris Mullin was Larry Bird's teammate on the Olympic Dream Team and also played for Bird in Indiana. While Molly and Larry may be white, they never cared about the skin color of their teammates or their opponents. Did you guys ever have a conversation about the Great White Hope thing, you and Larry?
No. No, never. No, we never even looked at anything but can you play?
Yeah.
Can you play? Then that's all it was.
It's amazing to me how people outside the NBA would like, in some ways, the way in which Tiger is looked at on the golf course, like, hey, there's a racial identification there. I want to see somebody who looks like me play. To me, there was so much of that going on with you and Bird and shoot, whoever, you know, Kevin Love now, JJ Redick. And I look at it and I go, you know, it's one thing to racially identify. It's another thing if you only like players that look like you. Wait, no, did you just say you're going to play at 5?
Yeah, I live on a golf course. This guy just pulled up. He hit a ball in my front yard. He says, you're going to play that guy? Yeah, when the sun goes down, I'm going to play. Yeah, I'm going
to play. That's just disappointing to me, Mully, because I thought you were going to get into a run. It's going to be the 3-on-3
No, heck no. Women, that's about it right now.
Yeah. Oh, that's great.
No, but look, to me, the basketball has always been the greatest connector in with people.
Yeah, you know, it crosses school. Race, it crosses a creed, crosses nations. I mean, you're right.
No doubt, it's a beautiful thing. And like I said, in the '70s, going up to Harlem and just playing ball, man, and just getting accepted. Yeah. And those people are friends of mine to this day. And it's really because of basketball. It broke down barriers, man. It's just a beautiful thing, and it never came up ever. It was just, can you play?
I love that story because Bird said the exact same thing about 20 years ago when I interviewed him about, you know, hey, if you're from Kuwait and you're 6'9 and you can handle a ball or you can shoot, you know, you're going to find a way. And to this day, it's good to hear that. While Bird never worried about skin color on the court, he didn't shy away from having an opinion about the issue. When journalist J.A. Adande joined the show, we discussed Bird's unintentional legacy as one of the greatest Caucasian players ever. I remember Larry Bird and Billy Hunter almost at the same time had quotes saying, the league needs another American-born white superstar to really take off. And it's not because it's racist. It's just because people want to see people that look like them and are from their area, the season ticket buyers. And I'm not saying that every NBA star has crossed over to not a black guy, just a ball player. But I do feel like, they're the greatest, whatever, white star I can think of that's from America now. I mean, J.J. Redick, Kevin Love, maybe Gordon Hayward. I mean, I don't think – and those guys aren't even, like, in the top 15 players. So I guess what I'm getting at is, do we even need – have we gone – I'm not saying that anything in America is post-racial. That's the worst term of all. But are we past – the notion that we need an American-born white superstar for the NBA to thrive the way it did in the Bird, Magic, Michael days. I think we bought into these guys so much that it doesn't matter.
I think Larry Bird's greatest legacy is that we don't need another Larry Bird right now. We absolutely needed him in the 1980s. Absolutely. It's funny. People say Magic, and I bought into that too, and I came up with that, and, you know, I was raised on that Lakers-Celtics rivalry, Magic and Bird. And it was always Magic and Bird. And really, the more I think about it, you needed Bird, right? If it was Magic versus Jordan, I don't think you would have had the success that the NBA enjoyed in the 80s and the foundation that was laid for today if it had been two African-American players. But the fact that Larry Bird was white, American-born, was, you know, multiple MVP and a champion, the league needed that at that time. And I think basketball fans have evolved past that. It, you know, the league will be fine without another Larry Bird coming around. I think it could go to new heights. It could go up a level, I think, if we were to have another one. But the very existence of the league, which maybe the existence wasn't threatened, but it was certainly on the ropes before they got there. Remember, the games were on tape delay, right? The NBA Finals were being shown at 10:30 p.m. on tape delay. And you wouldn't have had this boom that you've had. And I think we've gotten to the point now where, you know, like a Jokic can be embraced. Look at Dirk Nowitzki's popularity in Dallas. And how many athletes in Dallas do you think are more popular than Dirk Nowitzki right now, even though he's born in Germany? But he's one of them.
Dirk Nowitzki is the greatest Dallas Maverick ever. He just completed a 21-year NBA career, all with the same team. During his final 11 years, his head coach was Rick Carlisle. They won the 2011 NBA championship together. And if you ever wondered how important a player can be to a coach beyond the wins and losses, just listen to Rick talk about Dirk. I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you about Dirk and just what the post-Maverick Dirks are going to be like. I just remember being you guys coming to town to Washington, and you spoke so fondly of him. And I remember whatever he said, I just remember thinking, this is it. I knew it was it. He hadn't announced his retirement yet, but just the way things were winding down, there was a genuine affection on both your parts. And there was a sort of like, we know this is going to be probably the end of the run. What are you going to miss most?
Well, the person, you know,
yeah,
Dirk, the just one of the great people, just in terms of character, intrinsic values with respect to how he approached his job, the game, being a great teammate, those kinds of things. A completely selfless superstar that wanted to be coached and, you know, allowed himself to be unconditionally coached by whoever it was, whether it was Don Nelson, Avery Johnson, or myself. And, you know, the three of us, you know, I've had conversations with Nelly and Avery about Dirk over the years. And, you know, we all gushed the same things, the same, you know, the same praises, the same, you know, descriptions of, wow, you know, this guy's just so different. He's just not your typical superstar. He's so great. And, you know, it's just, you can go on and on and on. And so, you know, but I think one of the things that became a reality at the end was, you know, the last couple of years were difficult. The physical challenges for, you know, being, you know, 39 and 40 years old, presented themselves. There was surgery headed into the last year, which Dirk thought was going to be, you know, a positive thing. We thought it was going to be a positive thing. The recovery ended up to be longer and more difficult. And, you know, so he didn't get on the court until mid-December.
Yeah, that's right.
Of 2018. And it was just, it was just a really tough way for him to have to go out. Now, at the very end of the season, you know, he had 50 points in the last two games, back to back, home against Phoenix, on the road against San Antonio, and a couple of amazing tributes. You know, the one at home, you know, where, you know, he went for 30 points in his last home game. That was the night he announced that it would be his last home game. Five of the guys that he really worshipped and emulated coming up through the years were there as a surprise tribute. Charles Barkley, Sean Kemp was one of his favorite guys, Scottie Pippen, Detlef Schrempf, and it was just it was just such a special moment. And then, you know, that thing went on for an hour after the game. Then we had to get on a plane and go to play in San Antonio the next night. And they had a tribute to Dirk that was so emotional.
Oh, it was tremendous.
Brought him to tears, you know, during pregame warmups. And then he was able to go for 20 in that game. And, you know, so it was extremely special. And I, you know, of all the accomplishments that he's had in this game, you know, scoring whatever it is, 32,000 points, you know, being a league MVP, a finals MVP, 13, 14 time All-Star, whatever it is, you know, to me, the mere fact that he was able to get back on the floor and perform at that level, particularly down the stretch of the season, may have been one of his most amazing accomplishments.
I completely agree with you. And I look at all the guys who try and cut and paste their bodies back together to get to somewhere, you know, to that turn back the clock night. He had a turn back the clock few months that was just incredible. And is there any at any point, do you have a moment with him where you lose it almost, or just like, geez, not just the 2011 NBA title, but just what you guys have been through together, basketball and personal wise. And is there a Rick Carlisle, Dirk Nowitzki moment that I could share with my listeners, or will you keep that between yourselves?
Well, you know, there have been many over the years. You know, our team has changed a lot since the championship. You know, we didn't bring back the same team following the championship, and so, you know, really it's been Dirk and I since that time have been the two that have consistently been with the club. So, you know, we've been through some of the ups and downs. He's been great through all that, and there have been some moments where, you know, I've just gotten emotional, you know, about what he's meant to me and my family. I mean, I've got a daughter now that's 15 years old who, you know, if I can get through the next 4 years of my contract, we'll have been in pre-K, kindergarten, first, second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth, ninth, 10th, 11th, and 12th grade in the same school in the same city. And that, you know, that just doesn't happen much in this business. And I don't know if you saw it, Mike, but in the ceremony after Dirk's last home game, you know, I had my daughter Abby out there, and I talked just for a second about what it's meant to my family, and then she ran over and gave him a hug, and that was an emotional moment, you know. Yeah. So, look, he's just a very, very special person, and you know, I can't wait for there to be a statue out in front of the American Airlines Center to pay ultimate tribute to what he's meant to both the Mavericks and the city.
Dirk and Hall of Fame journalist Mark Stein of the New York Times go back even further than Dirk and Rick. When Stein was on the Mavericks beat, he and Dirk spent many hours talking basketball and life. And just as Nowitzki left a lasting mark on Coach Carlisle, he did the same with Mark. And I look at the Dirk 2010 year, or was it 2011? I can't remember. Was it 2010 or 11?
11.
2011. That to me, and I know you had developed a relationship with him over the years. That was a special championship to witness because, one, you really liked some of the people involved, but two, that was the year to get LeBron. Like, they were not quite there yet. He was still having a confidence meltdown in the crucible of his career, and it was, and Dirk just, like, I mean, I don't think people remember Dirk's finger was messed up in that series. I thought they were done after like game two or something, and for them to come back and win that, I don't know, that must have been one of your most satisfying finals to cover.
Well, he's someone obviously that I covered literally from his very first dribble in the NBA, and honestly even before that. You know, he was drafted, the Mavs acquired Nash and Nowitzki on the same day in 98. Then there was a lockout and Dirk stayed in Germany. And I actually went to Germany to watch him play for his hometown club team before he even got to Dallas. So when you cover someone that long, and look, you know this, I know you've done it in your career on various stories. When you go to someone's hometown and go all the way to the roots of where their career started, it changes your perspective on that player. It changes your relationship with the subject. So obviously there's no one probably in my life that I will cover from closer range than Nowitzki. But yeah, I mean, that team, like you said, you know, in my time covering the league, you know, I felt like the first Rockets championship was a team and a lot of very good role players. I think that's what the Mavericks were in 2011. The Pistons, you know, they were, you know, maybe they didn't have a superstar per se, but man, their top five or six players were really, really good. And I think the same thing with the Raptors. You know, there's Kawhi obviously on his own planet, but Lowry's an all-star, Gasol's a pretty recent all-star. They're a much better group than advertised. They're way better than we thought even when the finals started.
I agree. And I don't know, I was jealous because Dirk Nowitzki is from my mother's hometown, Würzburg, and I've been there many times, and I remember seeing your reports from over there. And I think Rick Bucher went over eventually as well. And I always thought, you know, if you're going to go to Germany and you're going to meet a guy's family and everything else. And he just, he never had any big time about him too. I think Dirk is one of the most solid people I've ever met.
When I went there, just to show you just how sheltered a life he had lived to that point. So he's 19. Mm-hmm. And I said, let's go eat. Let's go somewhere and eat. He didn't have a favorite restaurant. We drove around in his Volkswagen Golf for like 45 minutes.
Wait, he's 6'11", 7 feet. How does he drive a Volkswagen Golf?
That's all he had. What he had. And we drove around for a good 45 minutes until he finally remembered the restaurant that they took the Nelsons when they made their trip to go to Wurzburg and convince his parents to let him come straight to the NBA. So we ended up at that same restaurant. And then I said, okay, I'm here. I need to talk to your parents. And the parents didn't want to talk to me either. So luckily I talked him into it, but that was an interesting tip off to covering Dirk Nowitzki.
Dirk was a great player, while Jeff Van Gundy is a great coach and broadcaster. Jeff also attended Yale University as a freshman. And legend had it that Van Gundy almost dated a very famous movie actress while both were on Yale's New Haven, Connecticut campus. But does the reality match the myth? Did you ever go out with Jodie Foster, the actress?
No. I choked at Yale. So I had my chance. I had my chance and I blew it. And she went on the Rich Eisen show recently to promote a film, and Rich Eisen brought that up to her. And she said, Jeff Van Gundy, not memorable. Crushed me.
So people don't know the story. Jeff Van Gundy was accepted to Yale because it shows you how smart he is. He was a classmate with Jodie Foster. He was, I believe, in the same dorm. And I think that you and your dorm mate or your dorm room crowd of guys decided, all right, we're going to put in $100 each and see who gets to have the first date with her. Because at that point, she'd already been a taxi driver. She was a famous actress and she was beautiful and gorgeous and smart. And you're walking. Tell the story about you have your shot. You're walking by the popcorn machine.
Yeah. So, we all lived in a freshman quadrangle, huge, at Yale. And in that freshman quadrangle, there was a great candy shop right at the front. So I was coming back from the gym, and then right down the street, all these sirens came. And so I came to a stop right in front of the candy store as all these sirens go by. I'm watching the sirens. And the popcorn smells great. And after the sirens finish going by, a voice from behind says, man, that popcorn smells good. And I turn around and I'm about to say, yeah, it does. And it's her. And I stumbled, I stammered, and then I ran. And I just took off without saying anything. And so I choked to the most epic proportions. I lost out on the $1,200, and I lost out on meeting fame right there. So, yeah, choke.
I love it. Your line afterwards, which I remember printing, was, I vowed after that night that I would never be unprepared again. One man who is never unprepared is Bucks co-owner Mark Lazary. In addition to his leadership of a rising franchise, he also has acting chops. And if you're a fan of the show Billions, you might see him on a future episode.
I've heard a lot about you. I've listened to podcasts. I got to say, I also saw you in Billions once. And in hindsight, I'm a little disappointed. Mark Cuban got more airtime than you.
I know, it's bullshit. It's just wrong.
That's what I thought.
I know. I'm such a better actor. It's not even close.
You can't even. I mean, he's better on Shark Tank, where he's sort of really nickel and diming the guys on the set. You actually throw some action in there. Why do you think that happened?
I don't know. I think it was just the way they ended up doing the show. The one I was on was an ideas dinner.
Yeah.
So it was kind of different. I was supposed to be on it again this year, but I was traveling, so I couldn't do it. So I'll come back next year for a bigger and better part.
You turned down billions.
Sorry.
I
do have a day job.
All right, let's go. Time to stick the landing.
I'll do my best, Darlene. Hope you enjoyed the best of Mike Wise 2.0. This time it's personal. Thanks to producer Bruce Bernstein, editor Ben Wolfen for their work in creating this special show. Please listen to all of our Pure Hoops media shows. Buckets, Boards, and Blocks with Monica McNutt has Hall of Famer Nancy Lieberman this week. Nancy's stories are incredible. Catch and Shoot is always available, and the Pure Hoops podcast with BJ Armstrong and my friend Eric Newman has a new show each Friday. Thanks for listening. I'll see you again next week. Peace out, you hoopheads.
The Mike Wise Show used to be called the Wise Ass Show, but it remains a presentation of Pure Hoops Media.